And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. Today's Wednesday, October 23rd, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And some of you are emailing me and giving me feedback, which I am loving. So if you'd like to do that, email me at penonfire@earthlink.net. Tell me what you like about the show, what gets on your nerves, whatever you'd like to see more of. I've been hearing from a bunch of you, and one listener, Nicole, said, I've gone through the last 6 months of backlog just listening to the interviews as I walk around Chicago. I love that. And she says, however, one thing I noticed was that there's not been a lot of genre writers in the episodes I've listened to. I don't think I've heard any romance writers or sci-fi fantasy writers. When I've listened to interviews of authors in those genres on other podcasts, I've really enjoyed the perspectives and different things they've learned about writing, working within those genres. I checked your website, and I saw that you're looking to book authors of literary fiction, suspense, noir, and YA fiction, memoir, a little bit of poetry. I was wondering if you would expand the list beyond those genres to get perspectives on different types of writing. Thank you for that, Nicole. Part of what goes on here is that because we're all volunteers, this show has been a volunteer operation for 21 years. Marie, my co-host, and I tend to interview authors of books that we read. And, we don't tend to read romance and sci-fi fantasy. Not that we should not. So I will consider that and see about bringing on some authors in those genres, because I agree. I don't think you have to be a fan of a certain genre to learn from authors who write in that genre. So we will think about that and hopefully do that in the future. In any case, you can subscribe to the show, to the podcast via iTunes or Stitcher. When we upload a show, it'll arrive in your podcast file. My guest today is Steph Shaw. She is a novelist, author of Your House Will Pay and the Juniper Song Crime Trilogy. She's an editor and critic whose work has appeared in the LA Times, USA Today, and the Los Angeles Review of Books. She's a native of the San Fernando Valley, which is here in Los Angeles, and she lives in LA now with her husband and two basset hounds. She's going to be on my panel November 10th at Ladies of Intrigue, which is sponsored by Sisters in Crime, an organization of mystery readers and writers. And if you want to find out more about that all-day event, go to ocsistersincrime.org. And it's a great day full of panels and keynote speakers. And as I said, Steph Shaw will be on my panel. Let's bring her on. Hi, Steph.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Thank you for being here. Let's start with talking about Your House Will Pay and how the book came about.
Yeah. I started this book in late 2014. It's based loosely on a true story on a shooting that happened in Los Angeles in 1991 that I fictionalized and wanted to write about the people who were left behind by this crime, the family members of both the shooter and the victim in present day. You know, as I was starting to write this book, it was around the same time of the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, mm-hmm. and the national response to that, the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, the court case against Darren Wilson. You know, all of this was kind of happening at the same time that I was getting interested in the story of Latasha Harlan, and so it really became this. This project where the concerns of present day America merged for me with the concerns of 1990s Los Angeles. And I saw one as kind of representative of the other in a way. And I also saw the straight line that connected these two eras. And I wanted to write about that, in fiction, in a way that gave me kind of free rein to explore this topic through a tight set of characters.
So what inspired then the braided narrative from the beginning, which I really quite like, because we have two point of view characters?
Yeah. As soon as I knew that this was the story I wanted to focus on, I knew that I wanted to write characters who represented both families involved. So that would be the black family the black family members of the victim of this 1991 shooting, and the Korean American family of the shooter. I'm Korean American, and I just understood pretty quickly that if I were going to write this book from only the Korean American perspective, it would be very limited. And there would just be a lot of things that I couldn't get into. I think it would have been much harder to portray any side characters or non-point of view characters with the same nuance that I could getting into the head of Sean, who ended up being my point of view character for the black family. So I settled on, I didn't know right away that I was only going to have two points of view. I thought at various points that I might have more than that, that it might be more of a, the early drafts were a mess that had all kinds of kind of scrappy tidbits in there. But I always knew that I was going to have both of these points of view, even if they weren't the only ones. And then once I kind of settled on them, they guided the book for me.
Yeah, I quite like Sean's point of view being in the book. And as I was reading, though, I was thinking about controversy that's been going on the last year and a half, 2 years, about writing from the point of view of a race or gender that is not your own. And so obviously you don't have a problem with that, and you certainly wrote it well, but were you ever concerned with that? With, are readers going to object to writing in Sean's point of view, or covering black characters?
I wasn't so much concerned about, initially at least, about kind of reader reaction so much as I was, well, am I going to get this right? Because I am very much of the view that that yes, it is. People have creative prerogative to write outside of their own experience. However, I think that once you make that decision, it's your responsibility to do it well. Mm-hmm. And if readers are going to object to it because you did it poorly, then you've opened yourself up. And I think that it's fair for you to be laden with that criticism. So I knew when I started doing that I would tread with the utmost care and a sense of responsibility to not get it wrong. It was a decision that I made because I felt that to avoid that point of view would have been more damaging and more limiting than to try and write in it. So yes, I decided to do it, go for it, and just do it to the best of my ability. I think where writers get in trouble writing outside of their own experience is when they do feel a little bit cavalier about it and think, well, I'm creative, I can do whatever I want. And I actually don't believe that. And I think that taking on the experience of other people who actually exist, it's different from writing about aliens or fantastical creatures, who are not going to pick up your book. I do think that there is a heightened responsibility that if you're going to do it, you have to be ready to take that on.
Yeah, and so far there have been just only excellent reviews of the book. So obviously you did do it well, and you were careful in however you needed to be careful. So yeah, I love that. I love that. And I have to say, around page 85, I think is where the stories meet, Grace's story and Sean's story kind of meet.
Yeah.
And I remember gasping around there when I read it, because I, when I started reading the book, I wondered, how are these stories going to come together? And they came together so perfectly. Did you have that orchestrated, or was it a surprise to you?
Well, I knew what the background of these two families were, and I had a kind of interesting craft problem going into this too, which is that I knew that I was not going to really hide the ball when talking about the book, or in the framing of the book, that it's based on this true story, and that anybody who's heard of this true story or decides to look it up before reading the book would know from the get-go what the connection was between these two families. And so I had this little problem of having to make it so that the book is interesting and worth reading, even if you know that that's coming. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, keeping it surprising to readers who don't. And I think I concentrated more on the first problem of making sure that it was an interesting read, even with that knowledge. And so it was gratifying to me when I started talking to people who didn't know going in, who were really surprised. And so that was kind of fun, because I didn't realize that it was going to be a large surprise. And I think the reason it's such a surprise is that it's a huge surprise to one of the point of view characters. So it was not even intended to be like this gasp moment, but I think it is. I think the final connection has surprised people in a way that I find gratifying.
I thought it was great. And, you know, also, I mean, so many things I want to talk about regarding your novel, but there's so many themes at play. There's class, racism, hypocrisy. And I always think about theme because not as a writer so much. Well, no, I guess when I'm writing, I'm thinking theme, but not trying to come up with it, wondering what are readers going to parse from this? What themes are they going to see? And so what is your relationship with theme? Are you fine with letting the reader come up with it? Or at some point during the revision process, perhaps, are you refining what you think or what you hope the themes are?
You know, I was very aware as I was writing this book what themes I wanted to explore, but I also didn't want to shoehorn them into these very narrow points of view, because Sean and Grace, the two point of view characters, like they certainly aren't thinking about theme. I guess the ending is where they have the most broad vision of what they're going through. But it's hard to kind of get that in there in a natural way. I mean, so I feel like a lot of the things that happen in the book are thematic and do address a lot of the things that I had been thinking about when writing this book. But it's not that it's not there, but I tried not to like hammer it in, because I didn't want the characters to come off as more knowing than they really would be, or more like self-aware of like the things that are happening to them. The book, one of the larger themes of the book is the merging of the political and the personal, and that's something that's happening to the main characters on every page. So I didn't think that I really had to like to underline that, because it's just something that. That's what the story is. Mm-hmm. Broader themes of race and class, I mean, that just comes in their everyday lives and their interactions with each other, with their families. And, you know, so I kind of felt like I was going to get these things across, and so I didn't sweat, highlighting them too much for the reader, almost for fear that it would bog down the book and make it feel less immediate to the characters.
There's also a lot going on with appearances, how things are, what they appear to be, how Southern California is so sunny and bright, yet there's so much crime and poverty going on here, and so many hate groups, which people not from here, and even some people from here are so surprised to learn of all the hate groups that are kind of around Southern California. I mean, what do you make
of we have the highest number of hate groups, right?
Yeah, I think so. Were you thinking of that at all when you were writing the book?
Yeah, you know, I think it's something that this is my fourth book about Los Angeles, and it's something in the cultural heritage of LA. You know, Mike Davis wrote about it famously, that calling Los Angeles a place that understands its own history through sunshine and noir.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those contrasts do make Southern California, and I think Los Angeles in particular, like this great breeding ground for a certain kind of story of darkness and light. And I'm just interested in Los Angeles, you know. And I think especially since the 2016 presidential election, like Southern California has been seen as this kind of progressive place where, you know, like a progressive haven in the country. And, you know, I don't think that's wrong. I think, yes, our politics are more progressive. It is a better place in many ways to be part of a ethnic minority or to be a woman. But that also doesn't mean that we don't have our own problems or that we don't participate in the national problems. And that is one of the broader concerns of noir fiction generally, which I actually don't even know that this book fits into that category, but it's something that I have thought about for my other books as well. And I think it's an interesting contrast, you know. I think this place has held up as an example in a lot of ways, and of course, like, we don't always keep a clean house.
Yeah, we don't, but you know, when there's so much criticism kind of foisted at California as well. We were talking about this last night with Susan Strait, who was down here to do a speaker series event, and she was talking about, you know, how, okay, so let's build a wall around California and we'll keep all the food. We'll keep the strawberries. We'll, you know, it's just like, okay, let's think about California in another way, right?
Yeah.
By the way, and she asked me to tell you that she is reviewing Your House Will Pay for Long Reads and wanted you to know
lovely.
That she loves your book and wanted me to tell you that.
She's great.
So, you know, you said something a few minutes ago about, you know, does your book fit the category of noir? And so I was thinking about that, too, as I was reading, because I love noir. I write noir. And when I got to the end, I said, yes, definitely it does. Because the ending is so, while I don't want to go into it, the ending is just, you know, a perfect noir ending. And I wondered if you were thinking about that as you hit the end and wondered, you know, is this the right way to end this book?
That's so interesting that you say that, because I think in tone it is a very noir ending, but I guess what I meant by that is, like, my previous books are like classic LA noir in that they are PI books, and they are mysteries, and this book isn't really a mystery, and it doesn't, like, the problems are not solved, and like it doesn't really end with like the mystery going away in any meaningful way or being resolved. But yeah, I think this idea that we're kind of stuck with each other in this place that is not perfect. There is something noir about that. Although there's also something kind of on the ground, if not hopeful, then I don't know. I always wanted to end the book the way that I did. And I don't think it gives too much away to say that it ends with kind of a moment of bubbling civil unrest in Los Angeles. That was always the plan, to end it in this kind of set piece with both families. And, you know, for me, the way that I realized as I was setting up this story that there was never going to be a good way, a real way to wrap it up in any kind of nicely packaged way. I just didn't see what the good outcome was for these people. It's, I mean, because terrible things have happened to them, and they're not disappearing. And so I wanted to acknowledge that in the writing, and not kind of have some cosmic intervention where everything is suddenly fine. What I did want was for these characters to finally kind of recognize each other's humanity. And that was the moment when I thought that the book should end. And in a lot of ways, it's like, it's not redemptive, and it's kind of a feel bad spot to end a book.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that acknowledgement ultimately between the two of them that like they live in the same place, they are seeing the same things. I mean, that felt to me like it meant something.
Hmm. Yeah, and in terms of being redemptive, I think of other subgenres of the mystery genre as being, more that way. I think mysteries, typical or, you know, maybe hard-boiled mysteries, cozies. I mean, there's other in the genre, I think, that you want that. You want that victorious sort of ending. But with noir, I think no matter sort of what the plot is, there's always a darker ending, and it's not wrapped up, and you're left wondering, right? What's going on. I'm so curious about your Juniper Song trilogy now. I haven't read it. I haven't read any of those books, and so I'm so curious. And do you plan to go back to Juniper Song after this one?
Certainly not in the near future. I really like that character. I really enjoy writing those books, but I've switched publishers, and you know, I feel like this book is in kind of a different part of the genre pool, and it felt like a step forward in like the way that I was thinking and approaching craft. And so I think I'd like to kind of see what comes next without feeling beholden to a series that I already have going.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I don't know what that book is going to look like, but I feel like I would like to do something new. I really like writing those books, but like once I wrote one of them and figured it out, the other two kind of, they were not easy to write, but they were a lot easier than this one. And I learned so much writing this book. That, you know, if I'm going to like spend another couple years writing another book, I kind of want to go to school again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. And I'm with Steph Cha. Her book is Your House Will Pay, published by Echo. And I wanted to talk about Echo because, you mentioned that you switched publishers after the Juniper Song trilogy, and Echo, I think, is known more as a literary publisher, or at least with suspense or crime fiction, it's more on the literary side. And I wondered if that was part of why you went with Echo.
Yeah, it totally was. And actually, Echo is the only publisher I submitted this book to. My editor, Zach Wagman, he was hired in, I think, 2015 to develop Echo's crime list, but his list always leaned kind of literary or in that in between zone. Mm-hmm. So right now, like, Echo has Jonathan Leeson, Echo has Dennis Lehane, and Ivy Pakoda, a lot of people who kind of fall into that in between space, and I was, that was definitely appealing to me because that's kind of where I wanted this novel to be positioned, because it's not a straight crime novel, but it also definitely like deals with crime and in a meaningful and substantial way, and so I wanted to go with a house that could do both, and I think that was the correct decision. I think they've treated my book as both a literary novel and a crime novel, and to my benefit, I think, and to the book's benefit, because it gives the right signal as to like what you're going to get. Because I don't know. I mean, I worried a little bit about not giving crime readers what they want with this after writing three crime novels where you do get the answers, you know. So mm-hmm. So I'm definitely happy with this house. And I think they just have a really great list of people I respect.
Yeah, and I love what you said, that in-between space, because some of my favorite books really are literary suspense or crime that fits in the literary genre, where you know that the language is being, you know, addressed, that is being paid attention to, that there's, you know, something else going on. And relationships in this book of yours is a big deal. I mean, you learn so much about Grace's relationships with her mother, with her father, with her sister, and the same with Sean, you know, his extended family. There's so much going on, so much developed. And, you know, talk about that, just really getting your characters on the page, because they definitely are so on the page. And I think that's a pretty hard thing to do in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these are definitely characters who are in large parts defined by their relationships. So one of the main things that I did was to flesh those relationships out. You know, I think both Sean and Grace, this is one thing that they have in common. They think about their families a lot. That's the one of their drives is to be connected to their families and to protect their families. And I think that is something that is really recognizable to me. And I think there's a nobility to it, even when it leads you astray. And so I wanted to focus on that for both characters. And also because paying attention to their families helped me populate their worlds. And to make their worlds feel like, you know, these are people who could really exist. And you know, this is them like having dinner. This is them. This is the way they talk to each other. This is the way they love each other and look out for each other. And that was important to me. You know, it was much easier to write Grace and her family than it was for me to write Sean and his family, because Grace is a 27-year-old Korean woman, and I have been one of those in the past. actually, 6 years ago, I was one of those. So that was not as hard for me to crack. You know, and also, her family isn't exactly like mine. For one thing, my parents are very different from her parents, you know, certainly not any secrets that dark that I know of. But you know, there's something about there's something in those families that is reflective of people I grew up around. You know, knowing so many Korean American families in Los Angeles. And I just felt comfortable extrapolating from my own experience and the experiences of other Korean-American families I know. I think I was also cognizant of the fact that I wasn't going to be taking tests for how I wrote Korean-American families, a Korean-American family, because I think I was going to be given benefit of doubt for knowing what I was talking about. And you know what? I think that's fair, because I do kind of know what I'm talking about. You know, it took me much longer to get Sean's family right. Because I don't know any black families who live in Palmdale, and that's their background. They live in this exurb of Los Angeles, and they come from Los Angeles. And so I really worked on drilling down and making their family very specific, because I think specificity is one path to making people feel real. Mm-hmm. You know, I tried to think about Sean and his family as these real people and think about, well, what problems would they have, you know? So thinking about his relationship with his aunt and his relationship with his cousin, those things helped him come alive for me. And, it, you know, and I always kind of, both Sean and Grace, I had a pretty good handle on their voices early on, but that was these characters in isolation. And once I kind of got the characters pinned down in their communities and in their homes, I think that's when I started getting really comfortable with them and feeling like I knew them, and that I had like an intimacy with my characters that would translate into, you know, into feeling that these are people that you kind of know and like have spent some time with.
Hmm. Did you have readers to make sure you got Sean right? Especially Sean, I guess. Yeah.
You know, I didn't have, like, I didn't hire, like, sensitivity readers, but
are there such a thing? Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I think sometimes publishers will hire sensitivity readers. Huh. But, you know, what I do have is, like, I have a lot of good friends who are Black. Some of whom did not grow up in LA. Some of whom did. And, you know, and when I finished a draft of the book, I had readers for all kinds of reasons. You know, I had a dozen people read the book in full for craft, for I guess sensitivity, just to make sure that I didn't, just to check for my blind spots, for the kind of legal background stuff. And, you know, I asked friends and I would take them to drinks or buy them dinner, you know, because it feels weird to, like, pay your friends. But, you know, I think I would have been a lot more wary of taking on this project if I didn't have, any black friends to, like, mm-hmm. talk about what I was doing with. I had early readers who kind of read it just to see if I, as, like, a Korean American woman, just missed something completely, mm-hmm. And had, like, massive blind spots. And, you know, and there wasn't anything that I hadn't, like, really thought of, which was, and you know what, and that's a smaller group than the group of people that are reading this book now. And, like, I won't be, like, shocked if there is something that I got wrong that I will find out about in a very smart Goodreads review. But for now, you know, I have not yet encountered a criticism that I did not pose to myself first. You know, I think I put a lot of thought into this book and into the choices I made for this book. And so I haven't had pushback on that, actually, like, really less than I thought I would.
Mm-hmm. So would you have readers at different points in the process, different drafts, or did you get what you thought was the final and then distribute?
I got to, not the final, but, like, you know, I think the first draft that I really showed to people, other than I showed my agent, my editor, and my husband earlier drafts of the book. But, you know, it's like an unfinished manuscript is, like, such a mess. And, like, I didn't want to burn the readers before, when I still knew what I had to do, it didn't seem worth it to bother readers and, like, burn through them, because I wasn't going to ask anybody to read this book multiple times. So it was really when I had, like, a full draft that I sent off to my editor and that he had given me notes on once, I think that's when I started passing it on to other readers.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Goodreads. So you read your reviews?
Yeah, I do.
And how is that? I mean, you mostly get great reviews, so I'm sure it's a wonderful thing. But, I mean, do you ever read a review and you go, I shouldn't have read that, or I really never thought of that, I'm glad I read that, or how does that work?
It's still early with this book, but I've read reviews of my other three books, and, you know, a lot of the reviews that are negative, I don't agree with. but for example, my first book, I noticed that there were a lot of reviews that talked about, you know, it was overwritten or whatever. And as I wrote my second book, I had that in mind, and I do think there was something about that book that where I was doing something where I was kind of trying to write more of a direct Raymond Chandler homage, and you know, there's something linguistically tricky about that. And, you know, so when I wrote my second book, like, I wasn't thinking about that stuff, and that was more of a craft decision, because, you know, the main character kind of no longer really needed that particular anchor. But it was something I was aware of as I was writing, that, like, oh, I could just make it sound more colloquial. Although, I mean, I'm a very colloquial writer in general. But, yeah, I believe in the wisdom of the crowd. So even if I don't always agree with individual assessments, I do think that, like, if most readers have a certain reaction to something, then, like, they're probably right. But, yeah, with this book, I haven't really there haven't been enough reviews for me to feel like there's any unified, certainly negative reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if there is one, I'll be curious to see what that is. I've also always thought that this is a book that would provoke every kind of reaction. I assume that for political reasons, many people on both the left and the right will have some issue with my book. And, you know, I like to think I'm prepared and that at least there isn't anything that I haven't anticipated in some way or another, or like had a conversation with myself about.
Sure.
So,
well,
but yeah, I mean, I'm reading them now. I might stop. I haven't decided yet.
Well, they're pretty good, so I keep reading. But, you know, I'm curious if you have a thick skin, and I know you went to law school, and I wondered if perhaps, you know, training as a lawyer gives you a thick skin.
Oh, nothing trains you in having a thick skin like writing novels. I would say that you need a much thicker skin to write and to put your very, very personal work out there than it does to be a lawyer. But I will also say that I have not had... I wrote my first book when I was in law school, so I wasn't even like... You know, any kind of legal path that I have had has been fairly limited. So, yeah, I'm definitely more of a writer than I am a lawyer. And I wasn't really in any kind of professional environment that was very tense in the legal world. I did temp work for a while after law school.
Well, I'm curious, though, that you went to law school and you started writing in law school. Had you considered going to, you know, a program, a writing program, or you know, what happened there?
Well, believe it or not, I graduated from college with a degree in English, and I did not know that there was such a thing as an MFA. Like, I didn't know that that was a thing that one could do, and part of me wonders, if I had known that, would I have applied to MFA programs? You know, I wasn't a creative writing major. I went to school that offered English majors that bifurcated into creative writing and literature, and I chose to do literature because I wanted to, you know, I wanted to read the books. And so, yeah, I think if I had gone the other way, then I might have been more aware of my options. But you know what? I'm glad that I went to law school. I think it gave me a different kind of experience. I also think that, you know, I went to law school straight out of college. So I was 21 when I started law school. And I don't think I've ever in my life been more snobby than I was when I was 21, you know? And I feel like if I had gone to an MFA program, there's no way in hell I would have written crime fiction. There just isn't. And I think that I really found what I wanted to do by writing crime fiction and by writing, you know, I think if I hadn't written my PI novels, I don't think that I could have written this novel. And yeah, I don't know what I would have been writing, but I feel like it would have been worse.
Hmm. Well, I'm curious, too, if you ever wonder how an MFA program would have changed your writing. Do you think you'd still be writing what you're writing if you had gone through an MFA program?
Yeah, I think not. I think I'd be trying to do the experimental, whatever, mm-hmm. you know, kind of whatever is praised in the literary world. I think I would have had more, I would have been much more aware of that. You know, I don't think I would have written genre, frankly, going in as an impressionable 21-year-old who just wants to, like, have the most prestigious thing at all times. There's, mm-hmm. yeah, there's just no way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, and I think also my prose style is, like I consider myself a good writer on a craft level, but, like, my prose style is very, like, clean
mm-hmm.
and easy to understand and accessible, and that is by design, and that's also just, like, my voice. And I think that, you know, I think that I might have had more of an impulse to mess with my natural voice and in favor of, I don't know, some kind of thematic poetics.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about that, finding your voice. I mean, did you, when you started writing and, you know, still with Your House Will Pay, you know, what are you doing with voice? I mean, are you writing the way you talk? Are you writing, are you paying attention to whether you're writing, you know, Latinate words or, you know, what your language is doing? Or, you know, talk a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah, I definitely pay attention to all that stuff. I do try to write colloquially. It's something that, and I think it's part of it is because of the books that I've been writing, which are very intimate. My first three books were in the first person. They followed a single narrator. And this book is in very close third. And I wanted to, you know, without, even though these books are not in the first person, I wanted there to be a sense that you are with this person and you are in his head or you're in her head. And to do that, I wanted it to feel colloquial. And, you know, I think that is my natural mode to, yeah, I like using language that anyone can understand to highlight things that that are interesting linguistically or just in the world, and I think that's kind of one of the background projects of this book was to have these people who are, you know, who are just ordinary people. You know, I think actually in an early draft I had Sean be a writer and my agent was like, don't do that. it's like nobody wants to read about a writer except writers.
I do.
Well, you're a writer.
Yeah, I know.
No, but it was good advice. And yeah, so I think I am paying constant attention to, you know, certainly like, yeah, and I had to think about the language for this book, too. You know, I know that, like large parts of it, the dialogue, anyway, between the Koreans is in, like, Konglish. It's in half Korean, half English, and I had to kind of establish that early on, say, you know, what you're reading on the page isn't necessarily what they're saying out loud, because if I wrote down what they're saying out loud, like switching between languages every 5 minutes, it would be confusing to the mm-hmm, reader. Mm-hmm. You know, same with... you know, I definitely had to, the way that Sean's family talks to each other, you know, they use African-American vernacular English, and that was something that I spent a long time figuring out and making sure that I didn't mess up or caricature, because, you know, Black vernacular has been minstreled to, you know, up to its neck. It's something that and that's something I did not want to do, but I also wanted to make sure that when I wrote a Black family in Greater Los Angeles, that the family sounded like a Black family in Greater Los Angeles. So I studied up on, I actually like read papers on AAVE and kind of studied that as if it were a different dialect. You know, which it is. It has its own linguistic rules, and you know, I read papers with those rules laid out, and yeah. So I'm very cognizant of like the language that I use. Both in dialogue and in prose.
Hmm.
Well, and I have different rules for both.
Uh-huh. Such as?
Like, I knew that in the narrative voice, I wanted to make the narration a little bit more standardized between Sean and Grace so that they both sound like them, but, you know, there's less Korean slang, for example, in the narration than there is in the dialogue, and there's less Black vernacular than there is in the dialogue. I mean, that's one thing. And I gave myself a little bit more poetic license when I'm in their point of view, like in their heads, than when they're speaking out loud. Because I think that the thoughts that go through your head are often not articulated in specific words and sentences. They're more imagistic, they're more thematic. And so I felt like I had more leeway there.
Hmm. And after writing, you know, Juniper Song in first person and this one in third, do you have a preference? Do you know what your next one will be?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have a preference. I think first person is easier, or at least song was easier. But that might also just be because I have her voice figured out already. I think I think figuring out the voices is always like the first thing that needs to be done in any book that I write, at least. And so I don't know, I guess it depends on what kind of story I'm telling, but you know, for this one, third made more sense. I really enjoyed kind of, there are different freedoms that you get writing in third. You know, I think you do get to be a little bit more expansive and contemplative, in a way that's hard to do when you're actually like talking to the reader.
Mm-hmm. And I guess also having multiple point of view characters, it would be, I don't know, tricky doing first person, right? Switching back and forth. I don't know. I mean, it's done, but I don't know. It seems to make more sense when it's in third when you do that.
Yeah, I think it is done, and it can be done well. I mean, that's like the Faulkner trick, right? you know, recently Leila Lamy's book, The Other Americans, used first person for I think like 8 different narrators.
Mm-hmm.
That does have its appeal to me. I will also say that I was more comfortable writing from a black man's point of view when I was in third person,
sure,
than when I was in first person.
Yeah.
Or then in first person. And just something about, it somehow felt less presumptuous to do it in third.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We are so drawing down on our time. We have a few minutes left with Steph Cha. Her book is Your House Will Pay, published by Echo. And I have to ask you, because I'm a typewriter obsessed person. I have a dozen. And that picture of you in the LA Times with a typewriter.
Oh, yeah.
Is that your typewriter and do you use it?
No, that's a prop. It was actually that photo kind of cracks me up because I'm making kind of like a quizzical face, and like it's, and like the subject matter of the book is like so serious.
Uh-huh.
And actually like Attica Locke had a review, there was a review of Attica Locke's book in the same page of the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And both of us have this kind of quizzical face, and both of our books deal with like very heavy topics, and so that kind of made me laugh. That was the LA Times owns these photos because they were taken during the Festival of Books.
Ah, okay.
And they had like a station set up where you could come in and take pictures, and they had this and they had the prop books and the typewriters.
Sure.
So unfortunately not my typewriter.
Well, I love the picture anyway. And I also wanted to ask you about Yelp, because you're this major Yelp reviewer, I hear.
Yeah, it's a compulsion of mine. I've written, I think, almost 3,700 Yelp reviews at this point. I think that's in the millions of words. And it's something that I do out of habit and compulsion, and that nobody asks for. But it's also a way that, it is actually one way that I probably developed my voice, because I started writing them when I was, around the same time I was writing my first novel. And it's meant that, you know, I've spent a lot of time writing, even if it's just stupid, easy writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like keeping a journal or something. It's
right.
My version of a blog. But yeah, it's a compulsive habit that is very time consuming. But I haven't found a way to justify quitting it so far. And at this point, it's like, well, why stop now? I have, like it would make the last like 10 years of my life into a waste.
Well, but it's true in terms
of cost, I know, but
yeah, but I think what you said in terms of sort of developing your voice, I mean, sometimes, you know, writing emails, blogs, Yelp reviews, whatever, where you're writing naturally is a way to find that and to kind of know how you write.
Yeah. And I think that is, and I think that is true. You know, I think, before I started writing my first book, I was always a good emailer. And I took pride in my emails and like making them kind of funny, even when they were about nothing. It's something that I actually tell writing students is, you know, I used to be the friend who would read like grad school essays or whatever for other friends. And so I've just read a lot of personal essays by like friends of mine who are not writers. And it's incredible how when they try to write a piece of writing, a lot of the times it's less interesting and just drier and like so much less voice driven than when they write emails about something that happened or just to say hi. And it's something that I point out that, like, you know, the suppression of the natural voice in favor of art is not always a good thing. You know, sometimes the way you talk can be compelling in its own way.
Mm-hmm. And we're at the end of our time. I wonder if, I'm so happy, first of all, to have more time to talk to you when you're down here for Ladies of Intrigue next month.
Yeah.
That'll be great. But until then, I wonder if you have any words of wisdom or advice that perhaps an instructor or an influence said to you that has stayed with you for our listeners.
I might have to think about that one because I've taken one creative writing class and I took it in college. Let's see.
Well, I love that though. I love that you didn't go to school to be a writer and yet you're a writer. You're a successful writer. You have these wonderful books and, I don't know.
I think good advice that I've gotten and that I've heard and that I've given is the importance of reading.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you want to be a good writer and if you want to learn the craft, you got to read. You can't do it. You can't write without reading a lot. Reading in whatever genre you choose and becoming familiar with the conventions and the craft. I think that's the best way to learn. That's how I learned to write. Is I read a lot of books, and then since then I have, you know, I'm a better writer now than I was when I wrote my first book, in part because I've read hundreds of books since then, and also in part because I've written 3 books since then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, I think always learning from what you're reading, and also like what you're putting down.
Yeah, when I have students who say, you know, I don't have time to read because I'm doing my own writing and that's what I have
oh,
to
no.
do. I'm like, maybe not. Anyway, thanks so much for taking the time, and I can't wait to talk to you more next month.
Yeah, no, I'll see you in Orange County.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sure. That was Steph Cha. Her book is Your House Will Pay, published by Echo. That's all we got for you today. Email me at penonfire@earthlink.net and tell me your thoughts about the show and what you like and what you don't like, I suppose. I want to hear that. And thanks for listening. We'll be here next week with more Writers on Writing. Talk to you soon.